Welcome to New Books in Popular Music, a channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Matt Smith-Larman. In this episode, I talk with Steve Bergsman about his novel, The Death of Johnny Ace, published in 2012 by Dancing Traveler Publishing. This is the first time I've talked with an author about a book of fiction in this capacity, so I wasn't sure how to approach my interview with Steve. But then it hit me. This is historical fiction. The people, places, and things that Bergsman writes about in this book were mostly real. They happened, they lived, they played hot tunes. Bergsman writes of Johnny Ace's life in Memphis, his tenure in the Navy, his first public pop music performance in the Palace Theater, and his membership in the Beale Streeters, a band that included B.B. King and Bobby Blue Bland. Additionally, Bergsman details the important characters to Ace's story: manager James Mattis, unscrupulous business magnate Don Roby, girlfriend Charlene Lewis, and musicians Willie Mae, Big Mama Thornton, Rufus Thomas, and Little Junior Parker. All of this set in the pre-Civil Rights South, where segregation ruled the day, but also where it was becoming more and more evident to anyone who cared to look that the R&B music of African Americans was on the verge of crossing over into the radios and record players of white teenagers across the country. Tragically, just as Johnny Ace's star was about to explode on the national scene, he died by his own hand. In a not uncommon move, Ace, in a fit of macho posturing, put his favorite Italian pistol to his own head, declared his invincibility, and pulled the trigger. Steve Bergsman lives in Mesa, Arizona, which is where I reached him for this interview. Hello, Steve, and welcome to New Books in Popular Music.
Hey, Matt, how you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks, and thank you for being on the show.
Oh, no problem. This should be fun.
I think it will be. So tell us first, Steve, a little bit about your biography before we get into the book. Where are you from? How did you get to where you are, etc.?
I'm a longtime journalist, 30 years as a journalist. Mostly known as a business and real estate writer, and my first four books were about real estate. And then in recent years, I branched off. I did a memoir, Social History of Levittown, New York, where I grew up. Levittown was the first important suburb in modern times, you might say. First large-scale real estate development of that sort ever, and it was built for the GIs coming back from World War II, finished that book about 2 years ago, and then came back to Johnny Ace. It's a book that I started a decade ago, wrote it, put it in my closet, took it out about 5 years ago, worked on it again, put it back in my closet, and then took it out and realized I had a pretty good book going. So I cleaned it up, finished it off, and the result was The Death of Johnny Ace, which is historical fiction. It's based on Johnny Ace, who was a real and very popular rhythm and blues artist in the early 50s. And I could have gone with a biography. That would have been easy, but I felt that people really didn't know who Johnny Ace was, or if they did, they'd forgotten about him. I mean, he's so forgotten, he's somebody that should have been considered for, say, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but they don't even think of nominating him. Although in the years, say, from 52 to 54, he was the most popular R&B artist in America, and he was a cult figure in urban black neighborhoods. He was to African-American teenagers what James Dean was to white teenagers. That's how important he was. And when he died in his funeral in Memphis, there were 5,000 people who showed up for his funeral. That's how popular he was. And I was just reading some notes recently that in his heyday, 52 to 54, he had 8 straight hits, and he was the most programmed artist, according to Cashbox magazine. So that's how big he was and completely forgotten. And I thought, well, maybe the better way to go was to write about him, but in a novel format as opposed to a biography format. I thought that would attract more readers. And there's always been that mystery of how he died. So it's historical fiction / mystery, you might say.
Uh-huh. Well, before we get too much farther into the book, and you already mentioned this, I just found it interesting, the books you've written before, opportunities and strategies for real estate investing, the art of raising capital and owning property. How did you make the leap why did you make the leap from real estate to pop music, historical fiction?
Well, I've been known forever as one of the best known writers who writes about real estate, and it was very easy for me to write those real estate books. And in fact, the first one, Maverick Real Estate Investing, was an Amazon bestseller. It was actually, one time, it was the 32nd best-selling book on Kindle. I was outselling, all the popular writers. It was easy. That was easy for me, and those books sold well. But there were some books that I wanted to write, and I've always been an amateur musicologist. And early in my career, I wrote about popular musicians, and my focus was always on older musicians as opposed to current musicians. So I had been writing about those and those kind of performers in my early years, knew the story of Johnny Ace, and I just kept it around, that story. I always thought it was a fascinating story. And finally, I decided to do some books that I thought would be important to me, such as the Growing Up Levittown book, and then very quickly the Death of Johnny Ace book.
Are you still writing real estate stuff?
I actually just this morning I sent off a proposal to my my agent for another real estate book. It'd be the third Maverick Real Estate book. The first one was Maverick Real Estate Investing, then came Maverick Real Estate Financing, and if this one goes, it'll be Maverick Real Estate Residential. So these books are good, and they make a lot of money for me, but but I like writing about performers, and I actually started writing on a sequel, you might say, to The Death of Johnny Ace. So I don't want to say what it is, but I've already started the next book of this genre, this historical fiction type genre.
Great. So getting into the book, it is historical fiction, as you say. What kind of research did you do to dig up the dirt on Johnny Ace and his circle of people?
When I started the book back a little over 10 years ago, there wasn't much internet. So I started accumulating books at the time, and research, hard research in libraries and things like that you don't do anymore, on the Times and on Johnny Ace. I did some interviews. There were still some people around who were contemporaries of Johnny Ace. I interviewed B.B. King. So there was a lot of work initially. If I did that book today, there's a lot more about Johnny Ace. And indeed, there's even a biography about Johnny Ace out there. And I still have never read the biography, because I don't want anybody to come back and accuse me of saying, oh, you copied from the biography. So I've never read the book. I know there's a biography out there. All my research was original. And that's how it all began.
Johnny Ace over, a lot of these other pre-rock and roll musicians that you might have picked.
Why Johnny Ace? Were you saying, Matt?
Yeah. Why do you pick Johnny Ace over other people you might have wrote about?
For two reasons. First of all, as I mentioned, I think he's probably the most important and most forgotten performer of starting in the rock era of the 1950s. He actually predated the rock era. He died in 54. You might say the rock era began in 56. That's when rock and roll really started to appear. You had, some teen movies that had a rock and roll songs that came with it. You had Elvis Presley breaking out in 56. So 56 was sort of the key year. But Johnny Ace, unfortunately, died in 54. And his most important record, Pledging My Love, really came out after his death. And that came out in 1955. That's the record that everybody knows because it crossed over into the white charts. It was a rare thing for a rhythm and blues record to cross over into the white charts or the popular music charts at that time. So, he was a performer that people just had forgotten about. And B, there is that whole issue of how he died. And I'll just sketch it out for you. Allegedly, or the myth, or the great myth of Johnny Ace, was that before a concert, a Christmas concert in 1954 at Houston Auditorium, in his dressing room, he allegedly was playing Russian roulette with a load. You know, in Russian roulette, you put one bullet in the chamber, you spin the barrel, and you click the trigger, and if you win, you're still around. And unfortunately, Johnny Ace lost. And the myth is that he blew his brains out playing Russian roulette in his dressing room at this concert in Houston in 1954. So you had those two great things. He was forgotten, and there was this great myth about him of how he died. So that's why I chose Johnny Ace.
Mm-hmm. Set the scene for us. The story takes place late 40s, early 50s, mostly Memphis, a little bit Houston, a little bit the Chitlin' Circuit. Set the scene for us, please.
Well, you have to go back. Memphis was one of the great crucibles of pre-pop music. All the great performers who came out of the Mississippi Delta, which was just south of Memphis, they would migrate first to Memphis and play Beale Street. Beale Street was a street of bars and clubs, and it was probably one of the most happening places in America at the time for rhythm and blues musicians. So you came out of the Delta, you first stopped before going to Chicago or New York, wherever you were going to go. You went to Memphis, and that's where you played. And this was Johnny Ace's hometown. He was Memphis raised, and he got to see all these great musicians coming up out of the Delta, and started to play in Memphis on Beale Street. So Memphis was perhaps one of the great centers of music in the late 40s, early 1950s. I mean, this is where B.B. King started, and B.B. King and everybody knew each other, so B.B. King and Johnny Ace were friends, and actually B.B. King helped Johnny Ace sort of get established in Memphis, but everybody else coming up from the Delta also played there, and other names there were like Rufus Thomas. He was who became a pop star in the 60s, but he got his start in Memphis in the early 1950s. Junior Parker. Johnny Ace played with Big Mama Thornton. So all these great musicians were on Beale Street in the early 1950s, and this is the scene that Johnny Ace, he was actually born Johnny Alexander, changed his name to Johnny Ace, and this is where he started out in Beale Street. And even today, though it's 50 years past Beale Street and Memphis's prime, but if you ever wanted to go anywhere in the United States and see where the music started, you can visit Memphis. And this is better than Nashville, better than Cleveland with the Rock and Roll Museum, even better than New York. You can go there and see how all these currents of music got started. I mean, Beale Street is still there. It's not what it was, but it's still there. I mean, Elvis's home is in Memphis. Stax Record you can still visit Stax Record in Memphis. You can still visit Sun Records, where Elvis and Roy Orbison and Johnny Cash and all those first recorded is still there in Memphis. They're museums now, but And there's a great rock and soul museum in Memphis. So even today, you can go to Memphis and sort of get a sense of how rock and roll sort of got its beginnings. And a large part of that was Memphis. And that's where Johnny Ace was in the early 1950s, going to clubs, going to figuring out what kind of music he wanted to make.
So the story starts with Johnny Alexander getting out of the Navy,
right,
and coming back to Memphis, and he starts you're welcome to, you know, tell me what's fiction and what's fact, or we could just leave that up to the listeners and the readers. But he wears his Navy uniform, even though he's out of the Navy now, and he starts hanging out at the Palace Theater, right?
Yeah, because Palace Theater, they used to have this contest. You can go in and go in, and it was like amateur night, or what are the shows they have on now where you become the top musician? What are the all those shows? What do they call that?
America's Got Talent, those kind of shows.
Yeah, The Voice, all those.
Yeah.
But there was the Palace Theater had this amateur night, and the best musicians coming through would play there. And in my book, in the book, Johnny Ace, he'd go in and wear his uniform because he stood out in his uniform. How many African Americans were in the Navy in the late 40s, early 50s? Not many, so he stood out. And then he played in the amateur night, and he was a very good-looking guy. And it was pretty obvious that when he played, and he was a piano player, that he connected, especially with the female audience, and women, they just loved him. He had a very, unlike other rhythm and blues artists at the time who played sort of this hard country formed blues, rhythm and blues, Johnny Ace was a piano player. He had a soft voice, and he could really nail the ballad. I call it pre-soul, the soul music that came up in the 60s. But it really sort of, Johnny Ace was pre-soul. He had these great rhythm and blues ballads that just connected with the female audience. And he quickly became a very popular singer on Beale Street.
His songs, there's not a lot of, you know, jump to them. They're ballads, like you say, and he's on these reviews and these tours with people like Big Mama Thornton and whoever else. I wonder how the audience reacted to his songs. So it doesn't seem like they're songs that you would, you know, really jump and jive to.
Now, these were you might say they were anti jump and jive. I mean, he did some jump and jive. But if you listen to those songs, it's not as powerful as his ballads. And some of the ballads he'd write himself. And just his first hit, I'm trying to think, was My Song. And I think his first record that he cut became a number one on the rhythm and blues charts at the time. And it was strictly a ballad. And it was a song that connected with teenagers, African American teenagers, but most importantly, it connected with the African American teenage girl, and this was his audience, and they loved him when he performed, and you played the clubs on Beale Street, and then maybe you played the Chitlin Circuit. But there was a lot going on at the time, and one of the stories, storylines that in the death of Johnny Ace, so he recorded with a local company in Duke Records in Memphis, but there was an impresario in Houston and a guy named Don Roby, who had Peacock Records, And what's interesting about Don Robey, who's also absolutely forgotten now, but he was really the first great African-American, not just impresario, but the record producer. So even before Berry Gordy and Motown, which everybody thinks, he was the first great African-American record producer, Berry Gordy and Motown, and Motown was great. But, 15 years before Berry Gordy was this guy, Don Robey. And Don Robey, he had clubs in New York. He was an agent. He produced records. He had his own label. He started out with recording artists, mostly gospel, spiritual, very successful. And then in really unique, he was so strong and so big that he actually acquired Duke Records, which was owned by a white producer. He acquired it, and it became Duke Peacock Records, and Don Robey became the producer of Johnny Ace. So there was a lot going on in the early 50s in African-American music and in the music business that people don't realize. So not only did you have a guy like Johnny Ace, but you had a guy like Don Robey, who is also forgotten now.
You make Don Robey out to be kind of a mobster, kind of, kingpin kind of guy. How much of that is your fiction, and how much of that did you find in your research?
It's an interesting story. Don Robey was kind of mobsterish, let me put it that way, in Houston. And he had a bad reputation, and supposedly besides this great record business that he had, besides this music business and the club that he ran, which was the most popular club in Houston at the time, supposedly he ran numbers and had prostitutions and a prostitution line, and he was a tough guy. He was a tough dude in the Houston world of the early 50s. So a lot of it is true. He had a bad reputation. I think that's why they sort of overlook him now. Okay, he did these great things in music, but he had a shady reputation, so maybe we should just, leave him out of the Hall of Fame or something.
And the other important managerial type person that Johnny Alexander is associated with is James Mattis, correct? He was the Duke Records guy?
Yeah, he founded Duke Records. People were creating all these record labels all the time in the early 50s. It was the record world was wide open, you might say. There were the big companies like CBS and RCA, and and they dominated the record industry, but teenagers wanted other things, and these small record companies would really just start up overnight, and occasionally they would very good things, but their performers would become major stars, but only regionally, because they had limited resources and they could only get their records out regionally. And maybe if they were lucky, one of the big companies in New York or Los Angeles would pick them up, and they'd license the record, and then the performing artist would get a national reputation. But Mattis, he was associated with WDIA, which was the powerhouse radio station, one of the powerhouse radio stations in the Midwest. Now, you got to remember that this was the radio up until the 60s was all AM radio. It was only AM radio. There was no FM even. And in places like Memphis and Chicago, and there may have been a few others, they put these great towers out there and broadcast. And if you were driving in your, depending on climactic conditions, you could be driving in your car in Atlanta, and you might be able to pick up a bit of the Memphis station. So these stations had great outreach. And this was WDIA, one of the great radio stations of its time, which was owned by, that it had white ownership, but it made the transformation to rhythm and blues in the early 1950s. And this was where a lot of B.B. King and others, B.B. King actually worked at WDIA, and Johnny Ace a little bit at WDIA. Rufus Thomas was a disc jockey at WDIA. So it really reached the black audience that was out there throughout the Midwest. So this is an important place, and this is where Mathis got his start, and he created Duke Records right there in the WDIA studios.
James Mathis is associated with WDIA?
Yeah, he was. He worked at the station as well. He wasn't the owner, but I think he was the manager of the station. And he got his start elsewhere in perhaps in Alabama, and he was used to, he knew the black musicians in the Delta area, and he worked with black musicians. There weren't a lot of radio personalities or radio managers who knew that market, and James Mathis knew that market. So he was a perfect manager for WDIA.
As far as you know, how did he find Johnny Alexander?
Well, B.B. King was one of the primary disc jockeys there. B.B. King was trying to make a name for himself as a performer, but he was first known for his work at as a DJ at WDIA. And he used to, there's a lot of mythology how he became B.B. King. And he used to promote, you know, the DJs at the time would do jingles, they would promote products live, and that was all part of what they had to do. And there was a product, I can't think of it at the moment, but if you broke it down, it became B.B. And some people say that's how B.B. King became B.B. King, because he picked up these B.B. from the initial B.B. from this product that he was promoting on the radio. So he first became well-known in Memphis, besides as a stellar performer, but in his gig as a DJ on the radio. And I think after he left, because he had an early hit in the 1950s, I have to go back, could have been something like 3 O'Clock Blues or something like that, and it was actually a pretty big hit on the rhythm and blues chart, and then he gradually decided this was his life. He wanted to be a performer and not a DJ, and you got to remember, you know, if everybody has this vision of B.B. King, a big guy, heavy, gets out there, plays his guitar, but, you know, in those days, in the early 50s, he was also in service, and he was, if you ever see pictures of him in the early 1950s, B.B. King was a scrawny, scrawny fellow. So they were all hungry, you might say. Physically, they were hungry, and career-wise, they were hungry, and they all did what they could. Rufus Thomas, another great performer, he was, you know, he did the shows, the club shows, and then he became a DJ, and then he, too, became a great performer. So everybody was trying to find their way in the music industry in one form or another in the early 1950s before they figured they could make it as a singer.
Sorry. B.B. King knows James Mathis through WDIA and introduces Johnny Alexander to James Mathis.
Right. There's it's funny, if you remember back in the 1960s, there were these, I think they were called like supergroups or something like that. There was this name for all these major players like Eric Clapton. They get together, form a band like Cream and Blind Faith, and they were called supergroups because they took all these the best performers and they perform and they create an album or two. But in the early 1950s, B.B. King put a band together called the Beale Streeters, and he was initially going to be part of that band. But then he decided to go out on his own. And the Beale Streeters actually was kind of a super group at the time. They had, so he brought Johnny Ace in, and he brought Bobby Bland in. Bobby Bland just died recently, in, and a couple of other great performers, Roscoe Gordon, Earl Forrest on the drums. And in a sense, Beale Streeters was the first supergroup in America, because they had all these fabulous performers, and Beale Streeters went on the went out on the road as this great band, and then after going out on the road, they sort of broke up. Johnny Ace became a great individual recording artist. Bobby Bland became a great individual performing artist. Even Roscoe Gordon and Earl Forrest, not remembered now, but they had a few good records in the early 1950s as well, going out on their own. So that's how that all got started.
Important part of the setting, of course, is that this happens in the South in pre-civil rights. So not only is there physical segregation, there's music genre segregation. How do your characters in life, in real life and in fiction, how do they deal with the segregation?
Well, I tried to bring that into this story. Now, Johnny Ace, in real life, he was married and he had many girlfriends. And I decided to distill all that into one character in the book. I gave him a girlfriend, completely fictional, but she represented all the sort of women, you might say, in Johnny Ace's life at the time, and there were a lot of them. And the woman character, she becomes the first. He meets her, and they talk about who they are. And she's the first African-American saleswoman at the local department store. It's not even a department store on Beale Street. So, and she gets that job because the owner of the store recognized that so many of the clientele, his clientele, were now African-Americans, as opposed to, because the store was in downtown. So he needed to cater to his new clientele, and he hired this woman. She became the first African-American saleswoman in this store. So I'm sort of introducing what was going on in black America and white America at the time, through the story and through the characters. Also, when Beale Streeters go on the road, they're playing the Chitlin' Circuit, which was a circuit for black musicians throughout the South, and this is from all over the South way up into Washington D.C. So and there were never or very rarely there were places where black musicians can stay. They could not stay in the same motels or hotels or guest rooms where white folk stayed. So they often stayed in homes, somebody's home. Somebody would put them up in their house because there was no place else for these musicians to stay. So that's in the book as well. And I always found it interesting that there, so these musicians are playing the Chitlin' Circuit, but Johnny Ace in December 1954, Christmas, Christmas Day. He's playing not the Chitlin circuit. Don Robey had such a power and influence in Houston that he was able to book a concert at Houston Auditorium, a major venue at the time, for that was really just for the African American audience. So that concert where Johnny Ace died, you know, he was headlining with the Big Mama Thornton, another big act at the time, and a few other performers. Bobby Bland used to say, and I don't know if this is true, but Bobby Bland, before he died, used to say he also performed at that concert. But I had no record of that, so I didn't include that. But it was definitely the performers were Big Mama Thornton and Johnny Ace, and Don Robey was able to get Houston Auditorium on Christmas Day for a show for Houston's African American audience. That was in my mind, that was a great leap forward. For black performers.
Would you say at the time that was Houston a more segregated town than Memphis?
It's hard to say. Houston was more wide open because it was a growing city. Memphis, like a lot of cities in the Midwest, began to peak population-wise in the 1950s. And a lot of African Americans realized the jobs were no longer in the South, and starting, you know, going back to the 30s and 40s with Henry Ford and in Detroit and hiring African Americans to work in his plants, there was a whole migration going up to the North and the northern cities in the Midwest for jobs, they would stop in Memphis, but really. In places like Memphis, the population really began to stabilize, and there wasn't as much growth, whereas Houston was really on its way to becoming a major city in the U.S., and there was jobs for white America, there's jobs for African Americans. So it was wide open, and it was a wide open town, and that's probably why guys like Don Robey could make a statement in Houston, and change could be made in a place like Houston where it probably couldn't be made in other big cities in the South at the time, like Birmingham or Atlanta even. So that it really had to do with demographics and growth and what was happening in industrial America at the time.
To belabor the race relations point too much, but an interesting interactions in your book are between James Mattis, who's white from Memphis, and Don Robey, who's African American from Houston, but Don Robey is this African American man who's kind of bullying around a white man, which probably wasn't too common at that time.
No, and it wasn't. I mean, just the thought where a company owned by an African American bought a company owned by a white American, that's how unusual and unique in the early 1950s for that to happen. Don Robey's Peacock bought Duke Records, which was Mattis's company. And it was a very small company that James Mattis had, but James Mattis had Johnny Ace, and that was important, and that's why Don Robey bought his company. But an African American entrepreneur to buy a white company, that was a rare thing. And I had some other interactions in the book as well, where Johnny Ace and Mattis were driving through the South, and they get stopped. And why did they get stopped? They got stopped because it was a black guy and a white guy in a car, and the police stopped them because that doesn't happen. That didn't happen too much. I mean, this was, you know, the 1950s was a very, very segregated world in the South. So these were all these changes that were going on. You know, don't forget the whole civil rights movement. Began in the 50s and went on for another 15 years before the civil rights legislation of the Johnson administration. But all these changes were going on in the 50s, and even John Yates is a key. Thought in the back of his mind was, okay, I'm number one on the rhythm and blues charts, but gee, are any of my songs crossing over to the popular charts? That was always something in the back of his mind, because the charts were segregated, very much segregated as well. So, and it really didn't happen for him to Pledging My Love, but by the time Pledging My Love crossed over into the popular charts and getting as high as number 17, Johnny Ace was dead. And an interesting thought on that is, as you know, these great rhythm and blues songs in the early 1950s, the rhythm and blues singers who created these songs weren't appearing on the popular chart, but the big record companies would get get a white singer to sing these songs. So you always had somebody, some white singer singing songs that were originally rhythm and blues songs. And the same thing happened for Pledging My Love. So Pledging My Love was a huge hit on the rhythm and blues show. And I probably don't have these numbers right, but probably for a dozen weeks in a row, it was number one on the rhythm and blues charts. It was so strong that it actually created its own momentum to cross over to the popular charts. But by that time, Teresa Brewer, a classic white teenage singer in the early 1950s, had her own version of Pledging My Love. And the irony of it, her version also peaked at number 17. Just as Johnny Ace's version peaked at number 17 on the popular charts. So you had the white version of Pledging My Love competing against the real version of Pledging My Love on the popular charts. So it was strange times in American music before, say, 1956. Because in 1956, besides Elvis Presley, you started seeing guys like Chuck Berry and Little Richard, their songs appearing on the popular charts as well. So they were breaking the color barrier. But these things really, except for guys with the smooth sounds like Nat King Cole. Nat King Cole from the late 40s, early 50s, he always appeared on the popular charts. Or say the Mills Brothers or Louis Jordan, in the late 40s or early 50s, these guys had a jazzy sound or a smooth sound that was acceptable on the white charts, but the true rhythm and blues singers in the early 1950s, they never made it to the white charts, and their songs were covered by white America, and the white American versions appeared on the popular charts at the time.
Is that your work of fiction, Ace's fascination with Nat King Cole, or do you have some evidence for it?
In my research, I picked up a little bit of that, but it wasn't firsthand. Some of the critics or people writing about popular music at the time related that the early Johnny Ace songs had a lot of sort of sound qualities that were somewhat similar to Nat King Cole. So I put that in the book. So I don't know if that was true, but the people, historians, sort of made that jump for me, and I just created that situation in the book. Because I felt that if Johnny Ace was listening out there to everything that was out there, he would have known and he would have realized that's where he wanted to be, because Nat King Cole appeared not just on the rhythm and blues charts, but he appeared on the popular charts, and any performer, white or black, would have wanted to be in the same place as Nat King Cole.
Most of your characters, including Johnny Ace, including Don Roby, including James Mattis, they're including Sam Phillips, who's not really too much in the story, but they're really, as the popular story of rock and roll history goes, they're really looking to find a way to, they're looking for crossover artists.
Yeah, that was the, all this great music was coming out out of Black America at the time, but the world was segregated, and that's why Alan Freed was so important, where he started to, in Cleveland, he started to, in the early 1950s, he started to play these African-American musicians on his station in Cleveland. So he was bringing in these African-American musicians into his station. Then in the early 1950s, after Alan Freed, in big cities like Los Angeles and New York, you'd start to finally hear some of this music. Some of it was rhythm and blues, and some of it was doo-wop, doo-wop was sort of an urban American version of black music at the time, very popular, and the white teenagers got it, and the white teenagers in the early 50s got it. They said, "My goodness, there's this great music out there. I want to hear it." So they would listen to guys like Alan Freed, and Alan Freed, you know, he started to do these big shows where he'd bring in like 10 different performers. They each sing one or two songs, the next one come on, and he would integrate his show. So he would have the white performers and he would have the black performers. So this kind of revolution was going on. But teenagers, especially in the South and in urban America, they were beginning to hear these black musicians, and they wanted those records, the original. But it was tough. It was still tough for the performers to get that crossover action, and that's why it was important to guys like Johnny Ace to see if they were, you might say, bridging the gap. Were they selling to just the black audience, or were they selling to the white audience as well? That was important back then.
So another important theme in your book is, it's brought up fairly late in the book, but there's this other setting in your book, of course, of a you-like character and the professor, Professor Harkness. And at one point, Professor Harkness says, this is about the record industry. The story is about the record industry. And that goes to this theme in your book where Johnny Ace goes out to Houston and with James Mattis, and he signs this contract with Don Roby, and he brings it back to Memphis, and he's having beer with B.B. King and whoever else, and they're all telling him that it's a bad contract, and things kind of start going south from there.
Yeah, a lot of the record companies, even the big ones, but a lot of the small ones, they didn't treat the performers well. And this was part of the problem. Even Don Roby, who was black, he didn't treat his performers any better than the white labels treated their performers. Don Roby often hoisted his name as co-writer on these songs, because if you got co-writing credit, then you own the rights to the song, unless you sold it off. And a lot of people just sold off their rights because they needed the money. But if you kept the rights to the song as the author of the song, then you got royalties. Royalties came to you. So even if you see on a lot of Duke Peacock records, you'd see XYZ. and Don Robey as the writers of the song. Well, Don Robey didn't write any of the songs. He just plastered his name in there to get the royalties. And the other thing, and he also squeezed his performers. He didn't want his performers to make more money than him. So he wrote lousy contracts for his performers. It's the same thing what the white labels did as well. So and I wanted to bring that out in the book that you're famous and everybody wants your records and you weren't getting any money for it, and it was no 10, 15 years later was no different. A good friend of mine, who I think might have appeared on your show, Peter Benjaminson, who wrote the Mary Wells book, the biography of Mary Wells. So here was Mary Wells singing for Motown in the 60s. She was had the first number one hit for Motown, My Guy, and she was, before the Supremes, the biggest female star on the Motown label. But she had to leave Motown because she was not making any money because Berry Gordy wrote lousy contracts for his performers. So for her to actually make some money, even though she had this great number one hit, My Guy, and a number of other hits, and she toured with the Beatles, she had to leave Motown because she had a crappy contract. And it was the same with Johnny Ace and Don Robey. He had a crappy contract, and I wanted to bring that out in the story. And that sort of that whole strife between Johnny Ace and Don Robey culminated, and this is what I interpret to what really happened that night in the dressing room at Houston Auditorium, how Johnny Ace really came to blowing his brains out that night. So that's, this is my book. This is what I feel really happened. Even though my book is historical fiction, this is what I think happened that night in the dressing room. And that, and sort of the mystery, it gets solved. You might say, in my version anyway.
And in the room that night with him, in your story, there's two young female fans, and then there's I think James Mattis shows up, and then Don Robey comes busting in. Right? Is there evidence that Don Robey was in the room?
There, Don Robey was there. It was his show, and he was in the room some of the time. Now I've never gotten somebody has done better research since I have, because there's more about Johnny Ace now out there than there was when I started this book about who was in the room at the time. But when I was doing the research on this, there was no clear answer to who exactly was in the room at that moment when Johnny Ace pulled the trigger. But I think my feeling is Don Robey definitely would have been there.
And getting back again then to Johnny Ace, and throughout your book, he has this obsession with a specific pistol that he always carries. And it seems to give him, a lot of confidence, and he's cocky, and there's a couple situations where he gets into trouble, and he does this Russian roulette thing to make the other guy back down, and that's the story you're saying might have happened this one night.
The Johnny Ace, he sort of predated all this where rock singers became famous and prima donnas and full of themselves. So here's a young guy in his early 20s, and suddenly he's on top of the world, and he feels that nothing can touch him. He's the king, and he can do crazy things like play Russian roulette, and he's going to win because he's on top of the world. So he felt no fear. He was winning, and he thought it should go on. He'd just keep winning. And he just had no fear that, you know, death was around the corner. Death was waiting for him. And, you know, you see, you know, a lot of great musicians, they have no fear. They'll go out there and do drugs and or race their car at crazy speeds and crash them, like a la James Dean, or do drugs and kill themselves, maybe like Janis Joplin. But Johnny Ace predated them all. You know, when you think of Janis Joplin or Jimi Hendrix or Jim Morrison, or, you know, or just blowing themselves up, unfortunately, Johnny Ace got there first.
It's clear that the gunshot wound was self-inflicted?
Yes. Yeah, that's clear. No, I should bring up, I'm sorry, but in the book, Death of Johnny Ace, there's the death of Johnny, there's the Johnny Ace story, but I should tell readers that it's actually framed. There's a professor of music or sociology, but he's written some books about music, and there's a journalist, and they meet and they talk, and the journalist is going to write a piece for Rolling Stone about Johnny Ace, and they sort of frame the whole story of Johnny Ace. They sort of put it into context. So you have these two stories going on in my book, Johnny Ace story, the, you know, happening in real time, and then these two guys who are sort of meeting and chatting and discussing Johnny Ace and music, and they frame the story. And of course, the key in that is that the professor was actually at that concert. He was a young boy. It was his first concert. His family was from Houston. He goes to his first concert, and it's the concert where Johnny Ace kills himself. So I just want the readers to know that there's like two stories going on in the Death of Johnny Ace book.
The professor's African-American, and the writer is white.
Right. And they've known each other for a long time, and they're friends, and they have this great relationship, and they chat, and it's actually I like the story of the two guys as well as the story of Johnny Ace. So I mentioned earlier that I was going to do a sequel, and Johnny Ace is on, and it's the same two characters, the journalist and the professor, meeting again, but it's a story about a different performer. So I'll carry those two characters into the next book. But as the writer, I like them.
Do you know them?
People ask me. Sometimes people say, "Which one is you?" And I say, "Well, frankly, they're both me. They're both kind of two sides of my personality. One is the journalist, and the other one is sort of the musicologist. So they're both me, you might say."
Well, it says great respect for the professor, that's for sure.
You know, you as a writer, you create these characters, and I don't know if you can, as a writer, you cannot like your characters, but I sort of like the characters, and I love the Johnny Ace character. That's why I wrote about it. But you know, I had to find some way to put the Johnny Ace tale into perspective. So I created these two guys, and I thought it worked out well. So I had a lot of affection for these two guys I created.
Well, fabulous. I think we're about out of time now, Steve. Usually the last question I ask is what are you working on now? You've kind of told us that. Is there anything more you want to tell us about what you're working on now?
Like I said, I'll probably go back and do a real estate book. That's not really of interest to the readers, but I'll probably buy next book. But I'm also working on the sequel to The Death of Johnny Ace. It'll take me, you know, I'm an active journalist at the same time, so I'm working all the time. So it'll probably take me about a year to sort of sketch out a rough draft of the next book. So probably not till, 2013. I probably won't get the rough draft done until about 2014 on the next book. Hopefully, maybe by the end of 2014, I can clean it up and get it back into print. And hopefully people won't have forgotten about the death of Johnny Ace and the characters. So that's my hope.
And in the meantime, we can read your next and go back into your real estate your real estate canon.
That's right. But I just want to put a plug in for Johnny Ace. You know, he's not considered. I've never heard him considered for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. But I really think somebody should go back and say, hey, whoever's making these decisions on who belongs in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, somebody needs to go back and look at Johnny Ace and say, oh, this is a singer that belongs there. So there's my last pitch.
Well, and I think that was part of your buddy Peter Benjamin's pitch, too, with his Mary Wells book.
Yeah. So I don't know if you knew, but I had befriended Mary Wells, and in the years before her death, I recorded her interview. I was going to help her write an autobiography. So I recorded her in interviews extensively, and then Mary died, and I never did anything. And then Peter, who was writing the Mary Wells book, gives me a call out of the blue, and he says, I heard you had been working on a Mary Wells book, you know, 15, 20 years ago. Do you have anything? And I'd forgotten. I still had all those tapes. So I gave them to Peter, and I'm glad I did, because he wrote a wonderful book about Mary Wells. And he used all and the tapes. I mean, hours of tapes that he was able to use for his book.
He mentions that in the book. Now that's a great connection you've made that I didn't catch before. Well, thank you, Steve, for being on the show.
You know, Matt, it was wonderful. I really thanks for taking the time, and I love to talk about the book. So thank you very much for giving me this opportunity.
You've been listening to a conversation with Steve Bergsman about his book, The Death of Johnny Ace, released by Dancing Traveler Publishing in 2012. Check back with New Books in Popular Music regularly for more interviews with authors of books about popular music. I'm your host, Matt Smith-Larman. Thanks for listening.